ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed for coming. A little bit of housekeeping first. Could you all please check your mobile phones? Can you hear me? You can hear? I'll try and talk more closely into the microphone. On behalf of the Honor Frost Foundation, I'm delighted to welcome you to our third annual lecture, which is going to be given by Dr. Stella Domestica, Assistant Professor of Maritime Archaeology, Chair of the Thetis Foundation, and Director of the Maritime Archaeological Research Laboratory at the University of Cyprus. As Honor was born in Cyprus, and indeed worked in Cyprus on and off throughout her long career, it's a particular pleasure for us to have Stella with us this evening. Stella is a very distinguished maritime archaeologist, the author of many articles and a book on the traditional pottery workshops of Lesbos. She's the director of the Underwater Archaeological Research Project at the Nisia Shipwreck in Cyprus, the director of the research project at the Masotos Wreck, which she started in collaboration with Dr. Michalidis, and of the Ifagu Anchorage Project in collaboration with the Nautical Archaeological Society of Great Britain. She's been working closely with the Honor Frost Foundation for some time, and she has embraced our mission not only to advance particular projects, but also to offer training to students and thus widen the opportunities available in Cyprus for maritime archaeological scholarship. Her subject tonight is shipwreck archaeology in the Mediterranean, new times and new challenges. Thank you, Stella.
Thank you very much for this introduction. Before I start, I would like to express my sincere thanks to Honor Frost Foundation for inviting me to London and offering me their warm hospitality. I'm particularly honored to be invited to give the third annual Honor Frost Foundation lecture, not only because this is a prestigious event, but also because of the unique way Honor Frost Foundation has embraced maritime archaeology. It has taken only 3 years of devoted work to change the potential of the whole domain, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean, from difficult to feasible and promising. In this respect, when John McKeever, whom I thank in particular, for her meaningful suggestions and excellent collaboration, asked me to give this lecture, I was puzzled. Not about the main subject, because shipwreck archaeology is what I know best, but about the approach. Should I present my work on Cyprus, which would be a rather straightforward lecture topic, or should I put this work in its Eastern Mediterranean context of current archaeological research and realities? I opted for the latter, wishing to share with you tonight not only the results of shipwreck projects in progress, but also some thoughts of mine concerning the nature of shipwreck archaeology in the region. Some 130 years ago, in 1883, an underwater survey was conducted at Salamis in Greece by Christos Tsoundas, the same archaeologist who later excavated Mycenae. It was a remarkably well-conceived survey, innovative at the time, with a research objective that would justify a maritime archaeological project today, the discovery of the remains of the naval battle of Salamis. The operation was not successful, however, and had no follow-up. You see the final phrase in his report, Tsoundas' report. In fact, this was completely unknown to the archaeological community before 2003, when Yanos Lolos republished it. Could Tsoundas' scientific operation have set the foundations of maritime archaeology in Greece? Difficult, since it was innovative, but rather out of context. The archaeological trends of the period during those early days of archaeology didn't favor systematic research, especially when the first outcome was unimpressive or a failure. On the contrary, a salvage operation that took place a few years later made the news. An ancient shipwreck at Antikythera was discovered in 1900, and its impressive cargo, a selection of works of art, mainly bronze and marble statues, was salvaged in 1901 by a team of sponge divers supervised by archaeologists. The market and the archaeological community was ready for the Antikythera follow-up. Several bronze statues were recovered from the sea, and the Mahdiarek was excavated in Tunisia shortly after. Nonetheless, no proper shipwreck investigation took place in the Mediterranean before 1960, when the first underwater excavation conducted by archaeologists was carried out at Cape Chelidonia, Turkey, by an American team from the University of Pennsylvania, directed by George Bass. An impressive sight was again found in the sea. The unprecedented discovery of a late Bronze Age shipwreck from Cyprus carrying bronze oxide ingots was enough to initiate a whole new era in the history of Mediterranean archaeology, the introduction of a new subdiscipline, the underwater, marine, nautical, or eventually maritime archaeology. Since then, a lot of important shipwreck excavations have opened new paths in the archaeological research about ships and shipbuilding technology in antiquity, and of course, the evolution of seaborne trade. Surveys have revealed impressive numbers of sites, and these numbers are rising almost every day. The progress in underwater archaeology, however, presents significant fluctuations among the different Mediterranean regions or countries. If we want to be specific, for example, only Israel among the Eastern Mediterranean countries can claim leadership in maritime archaeological research. The reasons for this phenomenon are diverse, and it would take another lecture to discuss them. But it is possible to summarize one of the many results of this paucity in progress. Our knowledge about ships in this part of the Mediterranean has serious gaps. To explain this, I present very briefly the most important shipwreck excavations in the region. 8 Bronze Age shipwrecks dating to a period of approximately 1,000 years have been excavated thus far, 6 of which date to the late Bronze Age. Of those, only one, Uluburun, preserved a small part of its hull, which has provided unique evidence for the early use of the mortise and tenon technique. Were all late Bronze Age ships built on mortise and tenon? What was their size? We don't know. In fact, it is very probable that for Aegean ships, laced construction would have been used. But the rest of these sites, the sites on the list, are mostly scattered cargo assemblages, extremely important for the different sea trade levels and connections, but less so for the ship types. For the next period, what we call early Iron Age or geometric or dark ages, if you prefer an older view, the only coherent shipwreck sites we knew until recently were 2 from the deep sea, the Tanit and the Lissa. And of course, their depth means that they remain unexcavated. The ongoing, very recent excavation of a ship in Croatia, however, has provided important insights into the evolution of the laced shipbuilding technique. For the Archaic period, an era of seaborne colonization and a major expansion in Mediterranean maritime networks, the number of shipwrecks rise dramatically. Still, out of the 11 excavated sites with hull pieces preserved, most of Greek tradition, 6 in southern France, 2 in Spain, 3 in Italy, I hope I don't forget some. Only one was excavated in the Aegean, the wreck at Paputzburnu. Moreover, few planks from the hull were preserved to complement or to confirm what we suspected. Aegean ships of this period were also built with the laced construction technique, but tenons appeared, thus maybe paving the way for the eventual prevalence of pegged mortise and tenons joinery. When did this transition happen? We assume it was during the classical period, but the archaeological record of classical shipwrecks is not particularly rich. Despite the important technological advances that took place at this time, as for example the introduction of the trireme in the fleets of the major maritime powers, and despite the fact that seaborne trade connections became the epicenter of politics and economies. At the island of Alonissos, a massive 5th century BC shipwreck dating exactly to the period when the laced technique must have been replaced by the mortise and tenon, was partly excavated in the 90s. Its size has changed our concept on ship sizes. It must have been at least 25 to 30 meters long. Its cargo was estimated at approximately 4,000 amphorae and its capacity at 120 tons. Unfortunately, the excavation was never completed, so no clues are known about the shipbuilding technique. Another shipwreck, excavated at Magan Mikal on the Levantine coast, which was much smaller than that at Alonissos, but almost contemporary. More importantly, it was fully excavated. For its construction, both lacings and mortise and tenon joints were used. Back in the Aegean, during an excavation of another small ship at Tektas Burnu in Turkey, hardly any remains but a marble of Thalmos was found, thus adding a significant detail about the appearance of the ships. The catalogue of the classical shipwrecks have been enriched recently with the discoveries at Heraklion Thonis, the main Egyptian harbour before Alexandria was founded. 64 ships have been located thus far, only four of which have been excavated. One of them, ship 17, was most probably a river ship, dating to the beginning of the 5th or to the mid of the 4th century BC. It has been excavated and published, but was studied in situ, i.e. it was not lifted out of the water. Recently, in a workshop organized in Cyprus, one of the most knowledgeable scholars of mentioned ships, Patrice Pommet, summarized the history of shipbuilding techniques from the classical to the Roman periods. A lot of what he said is published in this volume of Dossier d'Archéologie. He emphasized the gaps in our knowledge about important issues, such as the size or the tonnage, shipbuilding techniques, how we pass from laced boats to fully mortise and tenons, the Greek and Phoenician traditions, the type and the technology of warships compared to those of merchantmen, and many other topics. He placed the focus, however, on the Hellenistic period, for which one wreck remains a key find for shipwreck archaeology. The Kyrenia shipwreck dated to the end of the 4th, beginning of the 3rd century BC. It was the first, and thus far the earliest, excavated shipwreck fully made in mortise and tenon, which preserved more than 60% of its hull. The keel was 13.8 meters long, and although the stern cabin was broken and nothing above the waterline was found, the very good preservation of the port side of the hull made it possible to reconstruct a seaworthy true replica in 1982. Thus, the Kyrenia shipwreck still remains a key project for shipwreck archaeology, not only because of its excellent hull preservation, but also because of the subsequent and highly successful Kyrenia II reconstruction project. And in fact, it is still the most representative piece of evidence we have thus far pertaining Olkas, the ancient merchant ships in Greece, in the Aegean. The shipwreck record remains poor in the Aegean during the Hellenistic times, another glorious period both for the big warships but also for the merchant galleys. We even know the names of some of them from the written sources, for example, Kelis, Kerkuros, Kivea, Phaselos, etc. But the hull remains of the other Hellenistic shipwrecks are rather fragmented. Still, they are all made with mortise and tenons. The Roman ships are well documented in the Western Mediterranean, so my list would be too long. Oh, sorry, that was a slide too quick. Would be too long. This is not the case in the East until the 4th century AD. The recent publication of a well-preserved wreck at Andirodos Island in Alexandria provided important information on Roman ships in the region, but surprisingly, the few pieces of planking recovered from the Antikythera shipwreck, and this is what you see on the slide, more than a century ago, remain an important source of knowledge for the Aegean waters. I end this brief overview with late antiquity and Byzantium. The maritime archaeological record of the 8 centuries that comprise these periods is particularly rich in the East, at least compared to the previous times. This is the end of antiquity, the beginning of the Byzantine period, and certainly another significant transitional phase in the history of shipbuilding, when gradually the shell first technique was abandoned and the new skeleton first technique began to be used. Pomé and Hehanov have published a very important paper discussing this major technological step, and I would like to emphasize this. Because in order to conduct a comprehensive study, the authors had a catalogue of 24 excavated shipwrecks at their disposal. The ones in red boxes are the ones in the Eastern Mediterranean. So 11 of them, 11 out of 24, derived from the Eastern Mediterranean. In other words, we need a lot of data from many different sites in order to make progress in research. This important catalogue of ships is, of course, perfectly complemented with the results yet more ships of this period recently discovered at Yenika P in Istanbul. I will end this overview here, as I believe I have said enough to make my point, which is shipwreck archaeology needs excavations. I do not exclude surveys, of course. They represent primary work, an overview of the landscape or seascape and associated archaeological sites. Archaeologists today have new technologies at their disposal, providing them with special tools for effective and low-cost underwater surveys, both in deep and shallow waters, and so much so that sometimes we don't know what to do with this technology. But the picture of pictures that we get from surveys is not satisfactory for the gaps I discussed before and for many others I didn't discuss. We need excavations which, unlike survey, remain a difficult and debatable frontier. They are expensive, destructive, logistically complicated, and they demand dedicated long-term commitments. Moreover, rule number one of the 2001 UNESCO Convention claims that excavation, I quote, may be authorized for the purpose of making a significant contribution to protection or knowledge or enhancement of underwater cultural heritage, end of quote. Because it is considered the most drastic activity directed at cultural heritage that an archaeologist can undertake. This rule has been discussed extensively since 2001, and the archaeological community has more or less adopted the cautionary approach that first considers in situ preservation in preference to the recovery of artifacts or complete excavation of a site. As Thies Marleveld has explained, all archaeologists can always find a good reason to continue excavation, and obviously I'm not an exception. Still, Although the purpose of the convention rule is perfectly understandable, one cannot help wondering on what criteria can a site be classified as significant or not? Or else, is there any site that it's not significant for the knowledge of underwater cultural heritage? Given the low number of shipwreck excavations, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean, almost every shipwreck site could be easily justified right for excavation. In my brief overview, I chose to stress the open questions on shipbuilding techniques, as they remain the concern of most nautical archaeologists. But of course, this is not the only issue around which shipwreck archaeology evolves. Cargo assemblages are found along most of the Mediterranean coast. There are different kinds of sites, of course. Some are disturbed, i.e. only part of their cargo and hull survive, or just scattered, i.e. only widely dispersed fragments survive. In both cases, a lot of the stratigraphic information is lost, but the value of their quantitative analysis remains very important. I would just remind you that Uluburun or Antikythera shipwrecks belong to this class. In fact, this class of shipwrecks is the commonest type in the archaeological record and usually consists of amphora concentrations. I cannot emphasize enough how important these maritime transport containers are for the study of ancient trade. I will only note that they are the only remains of seaborne trading preserved in such quantities that we can draw reasonable conclusions for them, and not only about the types of goods transported, but also about the networks of various sea routes used in antiquity. Many of the shipwrecks I mentioned earlier were found in shallow waters, most probably abandoned in harbors and covered very quickly by sediments. At most of these sites, the shipboard artifacts and cargo were highly disturbed. So we have either cargo assemblages or hull remains with disturbed cargo. So what kind of shipwrecks can give us the most comprehensive evidence about ships? Only one very rare class, coherent shipwrecks. But such shipwrecks are rare, and even then, only a few have been excavated. The 7th century AD shipwreck at Yasiada, Turkey, was one of the first shipwreck excavations where attention was given to a spatial analysis of the assemblage. Elaborate for the time mapping methods produced very detailed site plans. But I return to the excavation of the Kyrenia shipwreck, which took place 3 years after Yasiada and represents the best example of a coherent, fully excavated pre-Roman wreck. Still, testing the ship's spatial arrangement had to wait until 2004, when Susan Kadzeff organized an experiment loading of 384 copies of Rhodian amphorae on the ship replica. The team soon found out that there was not enough space in the hold. Richard Steffi then suggested that maybe a couple of planks should be added to the hull. But such experiments can take place today on a computer screen. As you can see, it was done for the shipwreck Dramont E, excavated in the 1980s. The digital reconstruction of the ship was conducted 20 years after the excavation. Moreover, this work was carried out by a student at the Centre Camille-Gillian in Aix-en-Provence, one of the pioneer research centers of Mediterranean shipwreck archaeology. There, in the 70s, the exemplary excavation of a Roman shipwreck at Madrac de Gien took also place. Apart from the excellent preservation of the wooden hull, the different stowage system of the cargo were reconstructed, revealing the sophistication of seaborne trade mechanisms. Subsequent French excavation of Roman shipwrecks followed similar approaches with excellent results for understanding amphora stowage, the spatial arrangement on board, and the site formation processes. And they are really numerous. It is obvious, I think, that apart from the number of fully excavated sites I mentioned before, scholarly tradition and experience also matter if we wish to make scientific progress. Such comprehensive approaches of shipwrecks are still rare in the Eastern Mediterranean for various reasons. Among them, we might think of the limited number of systematic excavations, but also the lack of research centers and or the research tradition that accompanies such institutions. I now return to UNESCO Convention, only to wonder how can we follow its stipulations, which are in full accordance with our economies under crisis, of course, when all these questions concerning shipwreck archaeology are still pending. How shall we train the next generation? How shall we pursue research, both in archaeology and conservation, if excavations are to be avoided or conducted only under very special circumstances? Moreover, in most Eastern Mediterranean countries, underwater archaeology is still in the making. So how can we start if we should not disturb the sites? Well, it is very probable that what the convention suggests is simply a prudent approach to excavation, as opposed to careless practices or treasure hunting. And if this is the case, then it gives underwater archaeology a valuable map with more than one path of management guides and best practices to follow. In the beginning of the 21st century, we are lucky to have a great deal of experience on our hands, good scholarly work already published, and new technologies at our disposal. We have to be creative, and we have to suggest new ways to continue. In this respect, I distinguish 3D mapping and in-situ preservation techniques as particularly important for shipwreck archaeology. Almost all underwater surveys have been using 3D recording techniques since the first applications of this method by Jeremy Green at Tectas Burnou and Pierre Drap at Grand Ribault in France. Unlike terrestrial sites, where 3D plans are often considered a promotional tool for public archaeology, in cases of densely placed artifacts like the cargo of a ship, 3D mapping, it's the only method available for faithfully documenting the spatial arrangement. It allows a cautious excavator to document a site in detail and map its components in situ. Moreover, the significant progress in situ preservation techniques, achieved perhaps because of the awareness raised by the UNESCO Convention, can be well combined with the potential for detailed documentation of the space provided by 3D technology toward an alternative strategy of shipwreck archaeology. Slow excavation, maximum research. The main objective of such an approach could be to minimize the risk to harm the sites, but maximize the fieldwork or outcome with intense multidisciplinary research. Obviously, this is not applicable everywhere, for example, to rescue excavations or endangered sites. Slow excavation and maximum research has been the strategy adapted in Cyprus on the basis of the local realities, potential and constraints, and it's still a pilot one. In Cyprus, however, underwater archaeology made its long overdue first steps only 7 years ago. And despite my previously mentioned skepticism on the key role of impressive shipwrecks, I have to say that much of the work done on the island during these 7 years has evolved around one impressive site, the Mazotos shipwreck. The Mazotos shipwreck is situated at a depth of 44 meters, approximately 14 nautical miles southwest of Larnaca off the coast of Mazotos village. It lies on a sandy, almost flat seabed and consists of an oblong concentration of at least 800 amphora, partly or totally visible before any excavation took place. The majority of the amphorae come from the island of Chios in the northern Aegean. According to the chronology of this amphora series, the shipwreck has been preliminarily dated to the third quarter of the 4th century BC. Carbon-14 analysis has recently indicated a slightly earlier date, but within the 4th century nonetheless. This is a typical example of a preserved ancient shipwreck site. The ship seems to have landed in an upright position on the seabed and slightly tilted to its starboard side. The natural formation processes created favorable conditions for limited disturbance of the spatial arrangement of the ship's material after wreckage. Excavation has shown that there is only one layer of amphorae fully buried in the sand, which stands on the hull remains. Thus far, only parts of the preserved hull, section of the keel and the starboard planking, have been exposed, and this is the bow area, and here on the stern. They are small, but enough to suggest that the rest of the hull may be preserved under the unexcavated assemblage. These characteristics place the wreck in the rare class of coherent ancient shipwrecks, especially of the pre-Roman period, with good preservation of onboard stratigraphic elements. As we could not afford a long field season or long field seasons, the excavation strategy chosen for the Mazotos shipwreck was to work in small sections rather than horizontally over large areas of the site. And you see it here. Oh, I can show it here. This is the areas that have been excavated. This approach had several advantages regarding both research and project management. The first one is that we minimized the risk of destroying the integrity of the site because only a limited area was exposed during each field season. At the end of the season, the excavated trench has been covered every time with a thick layer, 15 to 20 centimeters of fine sand, not the natural sand from the seabed, but silica sand, on top of which a sheet of non-woven geotextile is laid in place with sandbags. Thus, even when the intervals between the excavation seasons are long, the site is well protected. The second advantage: the different excavation trenches represent significant compartments of the ship, the bow, the stern, the main cargo, and the side extremities. Thus, because the coherence of the site allows for it, the data acquired provide sufficient evidence concerning the ship before full excavation of the site is completed. And the third aspect of this approach is that the different excavated areas of the site represent material assemblages of various configurations. Thus, they provided opportunities for the development of a customized documentation system. The objective is to develop a methodology that would allow for adequate recording both of the site and of each one of the individual finds in three dimensions. Also, that onboard stratigraphic elements may be reconstructed in the future. Digital photogrammetry was the obvious choice for the site documentation because it's the only way to obtain accurate measurements given the constraints of the underwater environment, especially depths below 40 meters. Since 2007, we have fine-tuned, redefined, altered, complemented, developed, subtracted, or abandoned various procedures and methods. The result has been twofold. The drawback was that after 7 years of work, we had three different kinds of data sets acquired with more than seven different finds of software suggested by three different associates. As a result, last year we decided to seriously reassess and restructure our methodology, a project realized with Honor Frost Foundation support. The restructure of the system, on the other hand, had excellent results. Nonetheless, this achievement did not come without a price. We also needed to recreate and correct all 795 tagged finds, only 448 of which have been lifted. And you see some of the work on the slide, how we corrected the position of each one of the tagged finds. A common question that we often have to answer is, why is the greatest possible accuracy so necessary for this project? Or another, is all this effort to achieve the greatest possible accuracy worth its cost in funds and time? The short answer is yes, of course, for three main reasons. A, this is the only way to develop and optimize the existing methods, not only for Mazotos, but for future excavations as well. The second, the reconstruction of space has to be done accurately. Otherwise, it's completely hypothetical or even science fiction. And three, we may not have the means to use all the data we collect now, but this may not be the case in the future, as the previously presented cases of the Dramond A and the Kyrenia shipwreck have shown. In sum, we make the best out of the drastic and costly activities involved in our excavation. Before I give some examples of our preliminary results, I will describe very quickly the mapping method we use so that you can follow better what I will show you next. So this method involves four main steps. One, we take photographs to cover the trench or the entire site every time we want to document something. These photographs are processed and a georeference point cloud is produced. This is how it may look like. It can look like many things. Parts of the point cloud that include each find to be mapped are cut and positioned in the 3D model, and these contain abundant measuring information. As I said, we don't use all this information at the moment, both on the artifact and its location. And in the end, a pre-created model is positioned accordingly. During the pre-disturbance survey, the positions of 140-layer upper-layer Kian amphorae were mapped using the digital model of one lifted lifted during the first field season. I mean, we're just using the same model. When the excavation began, however, it became obvious that the repetitive use of the same amphora model was not correct, because not all the Kian amphorae in the cargo had the same dimensions. As excavation progressed, three main sizes were distinguished and modeled accordingly. Still, each amphora presents slight differences, minimal as far as their capacities are concerned, but they created significant errors in the final plan as they lie very close to each other. What is the solution to this problem, since measuring and modeling each amphora is possible only after their recovery? After a long of experimenting, we decided that they would model in detail only the lifted finds, and this is how we do it with parametric modeling. Thus, it was decided that full-scale mapping of the assemblage in finds modeling would be undertaken only during excavation seasons and not during pre-disturbance survey. This affected our entire documentation strategy concerning the visible amphorae, which are numerous. As the half-exposed ones and those lying below are obviously not fully visible, in the photographs, we decided that they should be accurately positioned with the point clouds, but not modeled. So we use one model, one amphora model, just to mark their location, but we don't map it in detail. And this is how it's done. This decision, of course, was directly related to our research plan to excavate the site fully. If only survey had been opted, then our accuracy standards will be lower and another strategy would have been adopted. The reconstruction of the wreck formation processes of the Masdos site is one of the project's prime objectives. This is a very complex procedure with geological, cultural, and archaeological components. Our ultimate goal is both to document and plot any relevant data on the 3D site model and to create a repository database for the data that cannot be immediately identified. Hence, we need to distinguish groups of stratigraphic units with special significance for the different episodes of the site formation process. For example, the amphorae that are lying on their sides, outside the assemblage and on sterile layers, had most probably fallen from their original position during or after the deterioration of the hull and have been lying ever since on the ancient seabed. During the subsequent stabilization period of the site, the sedimentation process started, but at the same time, the site was also exposed to natural and human activity. Precious information on this process at Mazotos was given by a broken amphora. Under 35 centimeters of sand, next to a Kian amphora like off the main assemblage, we found buried a fragment of the 6th century AD Gaza amphora. As no other shipwreck of cargo assemblage exists in the near vicinity of the site, this shirt can only be interpreted as a stray find. We cannot possibly know when it arrived at the site, but it's certain that it could not have happened before the 6th century AD, because that's when these amphora date, i.e. more than 900 years after the wreckage at Mazotos, and its location may be indicative of the seabed level at this period. This find from 2008 season showed us that the different phases of sedimentation process are difficult to reconstruct, but they can be traced. We noticed that around the external walls of cargo amphorae, calcareous incrustations form oblique rings. Preliminary analysis showed that this cement-like layer consists of bryozoan species trapped in the layer of sediments surrounding these the amphora. In other words, these incrustations mark the seabed layer on the half-buried vessels. Although in the beginning of the project we used to remove these features thoroughly because that's what we thought we should do, cleaning the amphora, now we don't. Not only we keep them, but also we mark them on the amphora models. You see the amphora photography on the left and on the right, the models. And thus, we try to reconstruct the possible different seabed layers of the site's life. In this respect, like that. In parallel, a geophysical survey has started. During a short field season in 2013, supported by Honor Frost Foundation, sand cores were taken from the site and were sent to the University of Patras in Greece for a series of analysis. As a complementary approach, we have installed also an acoustical current meter at the site so that the results of the geophysical analysis can be processed with real data from the site environment. Another aspect of the site's environment was revealed thanks to the work of marine biologists who joined us during two excavation seasons. They mapped different types of fauna and flora, which had created different microenvironments in the assemblage, depending on the configuration of amphora positions. Apart from the obvious environmental interest of this survey, we're now working out whether the distribution of the marine life in the present and in the past at the site can help us reconstruct the site's formation processes. A master thesis and several conference papers were the fruitful result of these collaborations. Another set of site formation episodes were documented at the bow area of the shipwreck. According to the preliminary excavation results, only two amphora layers were stowed in the bow area. Most of these amphora, however, were broken in situ, in a disturbed but not entirely disordered position. You see here the patterns. This situation may be indicative of the wreckage episode or of a specific phase of the deterioration of the ship's bow, and you see how important the Carinia shipwreck is in this case. Another issue. Inside some of the amphora, but mainly on the sand, many olive pits were found. Although it is particularly difficult to have a clear idea about their exact location, of course, since we're excavating with an airlift, we observed that their numbers increased as we dug deeper. More than 1,500 pits have been found in the sand layers of the bow area, right above the hull remains under the western anchor of the ship, and you see the position of the different anchor stocks found on the bow. Our only chance to have a clearer picture of the stratigraphy in this case was when we block lifted the anchor stock. I mean, we lifted not only the lead piece of it, but a piece of sand underneath. This was transferred to the Larnaca Museum, where we discovered that more than 150 olive pits were lying in a single layer under this lead stock. So it seems that when their container, the container of the olives, were broken or disintegrated after the wreck, they were emptied on the seabed. And thus, this had happened, of course, before the anchor collapsed on top of them. We haven't yet decided how or if we should ever show the pits on the 3D model, since we don't know their exact positions. The pits, nonetheless, continue to be particularly informative. Find. In the stern area, a Kian amphora was found in an upright position, filled with approximately 2,500 olives. So the pits we found at the bow may only represent the content or half the content of one amphora. The excavation of the stern is not yet completed. Even so, interesting finds were added more information on the ship's space. A secondary cargo of jugs must have been stowed among the amphora. Their present position probably resulted when the bulkhead collapsed or broke, right after the wreckage or during a hull deterioration episode. It must have been an abrupt episode, however, since some of those jugs were found broken inside the amphora, and one of them had bounced off the assemblage. Some fine wares, now this is how you can see it if you see the profile. And some fine wares, most probably belonging to the crew or the passengers, were also found in the stern area, most probably what we see as the stern cabin. Despite my long introduction on the importance of hull remains for shipwreck archaeology, I have not spoken much about the hull remains of the Mazotov ship. that it's because I don't have much to say. We have been extremely careful not to expose much of them, and we even left in situ the amphorae found on top of the end of the keel, both at the bow and at the stern. The reason was that we are not sure that our backfilling technique I described before or materials that we used are indeed going to keep the wood fully protected before we lift it, if we lift it. More important, the conservation facilities on the island are not yet ready to handle a 2,300-year-old hull. In this respect, and in order to optimize our in-situ preservation method, in 2014 we did not return to excavate Mazotos. Instead, we decided to start another excavation project at the Nisia shipwreck. Can we afford the delay in both sites' excavation process? Many of the shipwreck's excavations I presented at the beginning of my talk didn't last more than 3 or 4 years total. I think, though, that not only we can, but also we must. Following the 2001 UNESCO Convention rules, or at least our interpretation of them, we must prepare ourselves before we continue excavating. Working at Nisia, a different, more shallow and less fragile site than Mazotos, has given us the opportunity to handle wood on multiple levels. Excavation and documentation, in situ preservation, and we followed the same system as Mazotos, and that's the final layer of the sun before we put the geotextile on them. Analysis and conservation, of course. The conservators in the Department of Antiquities of Cyprus in particular are going to treat the lifted pieces of wood in different ways. And as we recently realized, opting for one or another method of conservation is the subject of a fervent scholarly discussion these days. Additionally, more in-situ preservation experiments were carried out at Nisia, aiming to assess the burial environment and its impact on wood, and of course the effectiveness of our reburial methodologies. One half of an excavated log was reburied in its original position within the trench, whilst the other, which you see on the one reburied you see on your right, and these dots are the markers we put in order to be able to monitor if and how it changes. Or the other half of this log was kept for lab conservation. And also three sets of new wood samples, cedar, pine, and oak, were left at the site in different microenvironments, both exposed and protected. And in parallel, of course, the documentation team, our documentation team, added another interesting puzzle to his work, creating a 3D model of partially exposed hull remains, something we hadn't attempted before, and here you see again the point clouds we acquired during the documentation process. The approach to shipwreck archaeology in Cyprus that I have presented here in brief is a result of close collaboration with a team that has a true affection for maritime archaeology. And here you see the core team members, but there are many others who volunteer every day, every year, from Cyprus and abroad, and some of them are here today. Certainly, our method is subject to changes and may not be the best strategy for other regions. Its objectives, however, do not concern only this country, as there are priorities to be set and challenges to be faced by underwater archaeologists working everywhere in the Mediterranean, who need to continue comprehensive research on ancient ships and seamanship, optimize in-situ preservation and conservation methods, make sure that the next generation is trained and overall help underwater archaeology to develop in a sustainable way in the 21st century. Thank you very much for that.
Just to return to a slightly more banal and general level from your splendid exposition of your processes, and turning back to the Alonissos wreck, the Karingi wreck had created in my own mind an archetype for the size of ships in the Hellenistic period in the Eastern Mediterranean. And yet here we have a Greek period wreck, quite a bit earlier, three times the size.
About at least 2.5, maybe, if it's 25 meters long.
Would you,
15 meters long, or 14 to be accurate.
Would you care to speculate on whether the Alonissos wreck had some specific function or unusual characteristic, or whether we could expect to find many more of that size from that period?
As far as I know, there are big shipwrecks that have been located in the Aegean during surveys, but haven't been excavated. And near this region in Sporades, there are more, not that big, but big shipwrecks. I don't know if Alonissos is something unique. But and the excavator likes to connect it with the grain carriers from the Black Sea, and connect this with this kind of trade, which may be true because it's very big. But if we think of the inscription of Thassos Harbour, okay, it's later. But again, we know that there have been big ships, big merchantmen in antiquity. We just haven't found them, or even if that we found, we haven't excavated it fully, so we don't know much about the ship.
So you see a contrast between the smaller vessels like Kyrenia, who would do the coastal trade, and more the larger bulk carriers?
Well, I don't think it's a contrast. I think it's two parallel kinds of seaborne trade happening. And I think that this has always been the case. Bigger ships were conducting longer trips, smaller ones. Okay, Kyrenia was erected in Cyprus and most probably was coming from Rhodes, which is not a very long trip. But we don't know. The Makan Mikal, for example, it's a smaller ship than Kyrenia, and it has an Aegean and a Cypriot cargo. So we need more excavation. We don't know enough about, especially classical and Hellenistic periods. We know more about the Archaic, much more on Roman. But this, for some reason, this period hasn't given enough evidence yet.
The Ulubur ship compare to the Kainia, for example? How does it compare?
In terms of size or in terms of cargo? In terms of size, okay, the Uluburun shipwreck hasn't, in at Uluburun shipwreck, the hull, only a small part of the hull was found. So we can only estimate the size. But the size is estimated around the same level with Kainia, 14 meters. But it's an estimation, 14 to 15. And it's an estimation based on the cargo.
Thank you.
ancient microscopy being used to analyse flora and fauna on the ceramics on the amphorae. In terrestrial archaeology, they use obviously a lot of microscopy to analyse. In fact, to do the do not disturb approach in sites to analyse the contents of sites in order to establish more about it. Is there anything about the contents of the ship itself? Do you see that as an area where microscopy could be used, or as a growth area, if you like, for...
We wish. So far, no. But, I mean, about the contents of the amphorae, what we know, we haven't mentioned it, and thank you for that. We assume, and we're pretty sure, that most of the amphorae contained wine. A, because Chian amphorae were famous. I mean, Chios were, the island of Chios was famous for its wine. And of course, we have the archaeological evidence about it because most of them were found pitched with a layer of pitch inside, which was characteristic for wine carriers. So this must have been the main cargo. Olives may be a secondary cargo or just provisions for the crew. And the rest of the olive, we do find some seeds inside the amphorae. We have found fig seeds, some grape seeds too, but the sediment itself, it's very disturbed or hasn't given any results so far. The interesting thing about collaboration with the marine biologists, though, is that they don't want us to disturb the site because they think this is a unique artificial reef that we're destroying, of course. And the truth is that what we used to throw, cleaning the amphorae of the marine life, it's for them, it's very important because this is what they use to follow, if you want, the marine life biography of the site. As I said, we're trying to develop an approach. We're going to work together because many of the remains that they find, the shells, they are old. So if we try to find a way to date these remains, especially the concretions, the biogenic concretions of the amphorae, this will help us very much in reconstructing the site formation processes.
Anna, thank you for a very interesting presentation. This secondary cargo of jugs, I hope for your sake that they fit with the amphorae dating and the carbon-14 dating.
This is a known type. It has been found in sufficient numbers in the Athenian Agora, but in Hellenistic layers, early Hellenistic layers, end of the 4th, beginning of the 3rd, and they go on because the shape develops. Truth is that I haven't seen an exact parallel in 4th century earlier, i.e. earlier layers, but it's obviously the same type that Rotroff has identified. And Rotroff has said that they are water jars, but these were found pitched also, with layer of pitch inside. So these are wine jugs, must be wine jugs, since they're... And they were a complementary cargo of the amphorae. In fact, this is a pattern too in the Antikythera shipwreck I was looking at recently. That was also a complementary or secondary cargo of lagini jugs, again, tablewares, together with the amphorae.
Yes, you may be extending earlier the dating provided by the Agora finds, which would be good.
Maybe.
The people refer to the Agora finds and the dating as if this is the gospel, but in many cases it has to be. But it's good if you're providing another dated context.
Well, we know that for this period we have an Athenocentric approach to the Aegean archaeology, that's true.
Okay,
That's very true. That's why it's so hard to find team members, you know, because especially for this shipwreck, for Mazotos shipwreck, not for the Nisia, it's not only the extra skills, as you said, for documentation, computer skills, all the sourcing skills, but it's also diving skills that we need because it's deep and we need technical divers. So yes, maritime archaeologists have to be trained on a multiple level for the future. Otherwise, we cannot cope because we have to do it. It's very expensive. It's a very expensive expedition. Every time we go there, it's very expensive. We need to do the best out of this. We need to have a lot of people and we need to destroy the site in a controlled way. So if we can't and if we don't have the skills, we're not going. That's what we have to do.
Anyone else? Stella, thank you very much indeed. You've given us the most incredible insight and we're most appreciative.
You're welcome to come to Cyprus if you want in our next field season.
We're coming. Thank you so much. And now there's a drink next door. Thank you.